coming up on TechNation, Stanford professor Hank Greeley and his book, The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. He projects easy PGD, the ability to create many embryos starting from skin cells, along with a full genetic analysis. Then on BioTechNation, the winner of Bio's FutureMaker 2016 award, Dr. Howard Jacobs from the Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology in Huntsville, Alabama. All this coming up on this week's TechNation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
Once again, we ask, what's the difference between data and information? And the answer, again, is that information is data in context. This came to mind immediately during a recent European panel discussing the right to be forgotten versus the right to know. Or perhaps to better rephrase it, my right for you to forget everything I've ever done versus your right to know about it. Several years back, the European Court of Justice issued a ruling which compelled search engines to remove access to information which is inadequate, irrelevant, or no longer relevant in light of the time that has passed when asked by the individual. So there's the context of the objectionable data. The time that has passed with a sprinkling of inadequacy of information and or current relevance. And of course, whoever the information is related to must request that the access to it goes away. Now the search engines, well, they don't own the data. They only own the links to the data. So the right to be forgotten might better be described as the right to forget the links to any of that data about you. That, of course, is problematic. As a result of the 2014 ruling, Google has created a form and reportedly received some 500,000 requests at this writing, with roughly 43% deemed appropriate for removal. Google's online form, Search Removal Request under Data Protection Law in Europe, starts with the first overriding qualifier, your country of residence. A scan of the 33 European states available on the drop-down menu reminds us that the law doesn't apply to everybody. But even if it did, the bad news just can't be avoided. The links are only part of the problem. It's the data. And data is like air, all the Earth's air. Who can stop the air of Asia from blowing its way to North and South America and then on to Europe and Africa? And no, I don't want to hear from the climatologists who might tell me that I got my air travel paths all wrong. You have the picture. Like air, data just flows. One singular copy, and it can be replicated again and again and again. And there's no stopping it. Just as you can pass a law about the air of your country, and it doesn't protect you from the polluted air of your neighbors. Nobody tells Mother Nature what to do, and I'm beginning to believe that with today's interconnected computers and networking, nobody tells data what to do either. Listening to discussions such as these, I often detect an undertone of wanting to return to the good old days, when long ago and far away meant just that. But the internet is the distance killer, both in time and geography. I can as quickly find a pizza restaurant in San Francisco as in Rome or Buenos Aires, just standing on any single spot on the planet. While we can't escape the capability of billions of smartphones, I think we don't quite remember the way things were. My student ID card from graduate school had my picture, my social security number, and my home address. That's lots more information than you consider putting on one now. But then, in the good old days, it wasn't connected to anything. the power of data replication has forever changed, just as the fluid presence of what's information is in constant flux. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, the Dean F. and Kate Edelman Johnson Professor of Law at Stanford University, Hank Greeley. He projects what he calls easy PGD, the ability to create many embryos starting from skin cells, along with a full genetic analysis. Then on Biotech Nation, the winner of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization's FutureMaker 2016 Award, Dr. Howard Jacobs from the Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology in Huntsville, Alabama. While the name of Hank Greeley's book is The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction, I thought we might remind ourselves that there are many reasons for sex, only one of which is reproduction.
Well, there are many reasons, and there are also many meanings of sex. I'm not arguing that we'll stop largely identifying ourselves as boys or girls, or that we won't reproduce through meiosis involving two half genomes coming together to make a new full genome, or that we won't have whatever you, me, and Bill Clinton define as sexual intercourse. but you know, so you've gone straight to the bad pun buried in the title of the book. Any pun you have to explain is a bad pun. An end not only means the completion or finish, but it's the purpose. So this is, I argue, largely, though not entirely, the end of sex for conception. That's certainly not the only purpose. It's not the main reason billions of people have sex. But there are people who argue that it is the only legitimate reason. They mainly live in the Vatican City. And there are people who argue evolutionarily that sex is about reproduction.
Now, your first chapters are basically a Cliff's Notes on the science of human reproduction. It was fun to read all in one place, but it must have been tough to write.
You know, I hope it was better written than Cliff's Notes, but...
you know, I actually, one of those dumb people who actually read the whole thing, so I never had to go to the Cliff's Notes. I just remember them.
Yeah. I remember Classics Illustrated, the comic books, versions of the great books. It was actually very satisfying. In some ways, it's the most useful part of the book for me, because when I'm teaching law students or undergrads, and there's something about reproduction or something about genetics, I can now just assign chapters of the book. I struggled with whether I should leave it in because I think a lot of readers are going to find it a barrier. But part of me really wanted to be able to explain things to people in ways they would understand and maybe help some folks get a love of biology. It's just such a fascinating field. I fell in love with it, and I hope some of that emotion comes through in those first few chapters.
Well, first of all, to understand much of the arguments and the implications going on later on and the framework of what's going on later on, you have to have some basis in biology, and many people don't have it. And fortunately, you're not a biologist. You're a law professor with a courtesy appointment in genetics because you've done so much there. And I think that comes through. You're not presuming that people are coming out of the sciences as they're reading it.
You know, I think that is a great help in being a translator between science and non-science, to not be a scientist myself. If you get me talking about law, I can spew jargon without even realizing that it's jargon. But because the science jargon isn't my jargon, I had to understand it. I had to figure out what it meant, and I remember ways that helped me learn it. I think that gives me an advantage over scientists, ironically, in writing about science for lay people.
Now, most people are familiar with in vitro fertilization, and they presume it is because of infertility. And you cite a few statistics and definitions. By definition, you're infertile if you don't get pregnant within a year of solid trying, and that 10% of women in the United States are considered infertile, 14% of couples are infertile, and some 160,000 couples a year, as of the last time we took records, undergo IVF, in vitro fertilization, many along with pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. That's what we have today in order to have their genetic offspring. Now, we know there are several ways to accomplish IVF. Let's start on the pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. What exactly is this PGD?
Right. So let's start by calling it PGD because it's a lot easier.
We got it out. We don't have to say it again.
Yep. So PGD sounds to most people like science fiction. When I give talks, I find fewer than 10% of people have ever heard of it. It's taking an embryo at either the third day or the fifth day after conception and taking one or more cells off of that embryo, doing genetic tests on those cells, and using those genetic tests to decide, is this embryo going to carry genes that cause a nasty disease? Is this embryo going to carry genes that make it a tissue donor or a cord blood donor for somebody who's currently alive? Is this embryo a boy or a girl? PGD has been around for 25 years. The oldest PGD baby is now a strapping, 25-year-old, and it's safe and effective. The kids aren't born missing an arm or leg or other body part. The other cells make up for the cells you took away. But it's not real common. Out of those 160,000 IVF attempts a year in the U.S. and the roughly 60,000 babies who were born, about 8,000 of them will have been born after PGD. And more importantly, no baby is ever born after PGD unless it was conceived through IVF. Because in order to take cells from an embryo to test, you have to have the embryo. And if you get pregnant the old-fashioned way, at day 3 or 5, that embryo is halfway down one of the woman's 2 fallopian tubes. Good luck finding it. If you get pregnant through IVF, or if you make embryos through IVF, at day 3 or 5, that embryo is in the petri dish you put it in. It does not crawl out and move around. So IVF is a necessary requirement for PGD. And that's a limiting factor because IVF is frankly a pain.
Well, it's very painful, extremely painful. Let's go over that because a girl baby is born with all the eggs she's ever going to have. I guess some 1 million at birth, estimated 200,000 to 400,000 by puberty. And so this is it. And that's why they're harvesting those eggs.
Right. You can't make new ones. There's one dissenter who thinks you can, but the conventional wisdom, which I think is quite strong, is you can't make new ones. And they lose their power. They disappear over time, not just the 1 or 2 per month that actually ovulate, but the ones that are in reserve waiting. Many of them die off before they ever get a chance to ripen and ovulate and become a possible baby. So that's the basis of the so-called biological clock. Men make sperm normally until they die, from the time of puberty until they die. But women are born with a limited number of eggs, and that's it.
And to harvest them for the purposes of IVF, what do we do?
So the harvest almost always involves first many days, usually 4 or 5 weeks, of injections of very powerful and very expensive drugs to get your ovaries to ripen more than one egg. Because if you're going to do IVF, you want as many eggs as possible to maximize your chance of getting a baby. So these powerful drugs cause the ovaries, which normally only ripen 1 or 1 every 2 months eggs, to ripen a whole bunch of eggs. They also cause powerful mood swings, cramping, unpleasantness. You know, like everything in life, there are people who say, oh, it wasn't so bad, and there are people who say it was terrible. But nobody says it was fun or easy or good, even apart from the fact that you have to get a shot once a day for many weeks. Then when the eggs are finally ripe and an ultrasound is needed to show that they're really like in blisters on top of the ovary, to show that the ovary has these blisters forming on it, then you get another shot to cause those blisters to begin to get ready to pop, and they go in with a needle, basically, and drain the blisters, suck the fluid out of the blisters, and in doing so, somewhere in that fluid, there should be a ripe egg.
Oh, this sounds like so much fun. No, thanks.
Well, you know, I have to say, I agree entirely, not to mention the fact that the cheapest version in California is about $15,000 and gives you about a one-third chance of getting a baby. So on top of everything else, it's expensive and usually not covered by insurance. But one of the things that surprised me most in writing the book is how bizarre what we think of as natural conception is. It's amazing that any of us ever got born, yeah. Either naturally or through IVF.
We're all really lucky. When you read the book, you understand that. Really, really lucky as we have.
You know, somebody had to be us, but it didn't have to be us.
Sure didn't look like it. The odds were against it.
Yep.
Now, over time, science always learns more and more, and technology gets better, faster, cheaper. Let's go to what you anticipate over the next 20 to 40 years, what you've termed easy PGD.
Sure, and I have a hint for listeners. If you're going to make a bold prediction, set the time frame beyond your life expectancy. So setting this at 20 to 40 years, I'm 64. I don't expect to see 40 years from now, so I can never be proven wrong. This is an advantage. I think two different technologies that are already moving forward are going to come together to create easy PGD. The one that is more advanced is cheap whole genome sequencing, where we've seen the cost of sequencing, of spelling out, of reading an entire human genome, all 3.2 billion characters of it, fall from $500 million to $50,000 to $1,500, and it's still going down. That's going to make it possible to read not just Huntington's disease alleles, immune system variations, boy or girl from an embryo, but read everything that genetics can tell us about every embryo. The bigger deal, though, is coming along from stem cell research, and a particular part of stem cell research called induced pluripotent stem cells, little I, capital PSC, invented or discovered by Shinya Yamanaka in 2007. He got the Nobel Prize in 2012, which is practically a world land speed record for getting a Nobel Prize. And what this does is take skin cells and turn them into things that look all the world like embryonic stem cells. I think everybody remembers from the political discussions of a decade ago, human embryonic stem cells. They're exciting because they can turn into every human cell type. They're controversial because they require you to destroy embryos. Induced pluripotent stem cells don't require you to destroy embryos. They look like they can turn into every human cell type. And best of all, for these purposes, they are your genome. They're not the DNA from some unknown embryo. They're the DNA from you. So what I think is going to happen will be we can take skin cells from you, we can hit them up with a cocktail of proteins that turns them into these iPSCs, these induced pluripotent stem cells. We can then hit them up with another cocktail of factors that convinces those cells to become eggs. We can then mature the eggs and use them, fertilize them with sperm, and make embryos. That way you avoid egg harvest. And if you avoid egg harvest, you've avoided 90% of the cost of IVF and 100% of the hassle and the risk. About 0.5% of women who go through IVF end up in the hospital every year. Every few years, somebody dies. It's not a god-awful procedure. 160,000 American women go through it every year. But if you can avoid that, the idea of IVF and thus PGD becomes a lot more attractive. So cheap whole genome sequencing plus stem cell-derived eggs equals easy PGD.
Does all of science agree we can do this?
I don't think anybody is certain we can do this. No one should be certain we can do it. We haven't done it yet in humans. We have done it in mice, which is encouraging, but of course we can do anything in mice. the way scientists will eventually cure human disease is turn us all into mice, because we can cure anything in a mouse. But it is encouraging that it can be done in mice, and there seems to be no inherent barrier. There are minor ways in which iPSCs, these induced stem cells, seem to be behaving a little differently from embryonic stem cells. And one of the reasons I put this 20 to 40 years out, it isn't the science, it's the safety testing. Before you make babies, human babies, from eggs that you've made from skin cells, you better be damn sure it's not going to produce seriously disabled or harmed babies. So I think the safety testing will be a big issue. With humans, we haven't yet made eggs or sperm, though we have made sperm precursors, things that look like the normal kinds of cells that later give rise to sperm. My own subjective assessment, for what it's worth, is it's 90% or so likely that we'll be able to make eggs from skin cells through iPSCs that will be able safely to make babies. Not 100%, but the odds are pretty good.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Hank Greeley. He's the Dean F. and Kate Edelman Johnson Professor of Law and Professor by Courtesy of Genetics at Stanford University. His book is The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. Now, one of the aspects which is interesting about this is because you could create viable embryos, you're saying, well, let's make 100. Let's make 200, whatever number, and then start to select from there. You provide information about a screening of just 5 in your book and suggest we make a choice. I couldn't choose. They all look good.
You know, neither could I. And I think the hardest thing about this technology will be educating the prospective parents so that they can make a choice that they're comfortable with, and so that they understand when we say things like, this embryo has a 13% chance of being in the top 10% in math ability. Remembering that means it has an 87% chance of not being in the top 10%. So getting the parents to understand both what the issues are, come up with a framework for trying to make their own choices, and then understand the implications of those choices, it's going to be really challenging. We don't have enough genetic counselors today. If we needed genetic counselors for, say, 3 million people intending to have babies, that's going to be a booming field.
Now, in parallel with what is going on is our comprehension of more about the genome and the fact that we are able to decode whole genomes. We weren't able really to do that before, and now we're able to do it on a large scale so that we're talking about looking at the whole genome of an embryo and also science looking at what that means.
Right, and I think that is one of the big game changers. When you do the cheapest, most effective test, you get everything. Even if you're only interested in one thing, it's going to be just as cheap to do it all. So I think prospective parents will be presented with 5 categories of data and ask, what do you want to know about? I think the one most people will want to know about is the 6,000 or so really nasty early onset genetic diseases. Each one, happily, is pretty rare, but you add 6,000 rare things together and you get about 1 to 2% of births have a genetic disease that could be predicted from PGD. Then you've got all the other diseases: breast cancer susceptibility, Alzheimer's susceptibility, colon cancer susceptibility, things that don't happen immediately and things that aren't 100%, but that some people will want to know about. Then you've got cosmetics. You know, we know that hair color, eye color, skin color, unless the hair color comes out of a bottle, is largely genetically determined. We don't know much about it at this point because they're not diseases. And so there hasn't been a lot of National Institutes of Health funding for it, but we will. And then the fourth and the trickiest, I think, will be behavioral traits. We know that there are genetic associations with things like personality types, math ability, music ability, sports ability, but anything involving the brain is really complicated. Lots of genes get used. Experience is really important. My guess, and it's only a guess, is that we won't be able to do much better than to say, this embryo has a 60% chance of being in the top half, or a 13% chance of being in the top 10%. We know a lot about things that cause really terrible behaviors, genes that when mutated in a particular way cause diseased behaviors, but we don't know anything about the genes that cause normal or above normal behavior. And even 40 years from now, I don't think we'll know much more. The last one is the easiest one, boy or girl. So parents, I think, will be asked, do you want to know about the nasty early diseases? Do you want to know about other diseases? Do you want to know about cosmetics? Do you want to know about behavioral traits? By the way, we can't tell you much. And do you want to know boy and girl? And they'll get the information, and then they'll have to make a decision.
What this says to me is that with all the availability of more and more genetic information, even if you don't have a problem with fertility, in fact, you don't know what's lurking in your DNA. So if you're going to try to have a family now, you might want to go down, and I'm just not suggesting that you do, you might want to go down and see what's lurking in your DNA. You've got a whole genome here. Both of you have whole genomes. What could be there that you didn't know about? And I think that's an interesting concept.
Right, and I think we'll see more of that. We're already seeing companies that are doing pre-pregnancy genetic carrier screening, so the prospective parents find out what they're carrying. I think ultimately, though, embryo selection through EZPGD is even more attractive because not only do you look at things you know will be potentially dangerous, but you get to see everything that's there, and you also get to pick up what may be new mutations in the embryo. Mutations happen all the time. We tend to underestimate them. And so embryos sometimes will pick up bad things that their parents didn't have.
Now, this all requires a lot of scientific research and technology development. And you point out that this requires funding. The more significant the potential use, the greater the chances of getting the resources needed for research and development. What do you see as the larger picture for where this science and technology might be applied?
As our knowledge of genetics continues to improve and our ability to do things with assisted reproduction continues to improve, one way or the other, and at different rates in different countries, in different cultures, and different uptake from people with different personalities and beliefs, but one way or the other, genetic selection or genetic modification of our offspring is going to become much more real.
I'm speaking with Stanford professor Hank Greeley, the author of The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, the winner of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization's FutureMaker 2016 Award and their work in genetics looking for rare disease. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You are listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Stanford professor Hank Greeley, the author of The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction.
Genetic selection or genetic modification of our offspring is going to become much more real. For example, I think we'll probably within 10 or 15 years do a whole genome sequence on every newborn. We already test newborns in the U.S. for 50 genetic diseases. Pretty soon it's going to be cheaper to get a whole genome sequence. An area that I don't talk about much in the book that I think is a couple of decades farther off for safety reasons than the embryo selection that is PGD or easy PGD is embryo editing using CRISPR, the new hot new gene editing tool, to not just pick which embryo you want from two people, but maybe give that embryo genetic variations that the two parents didn't have. Let two people with blue eyes have a brown-eyed kid, or more significantly, let them choose a child that has, say, a resistance to disease that very few people have. So I don't know where it's going to end. Niels Bohr supposedly regularly said, it's always hard to predict things, especially the future. Niels Bohr, not Yogi Berra. But he was wrong. I can't say that very often about a wonderful physicist, but it's easy to predict things. It's just hard to be right about them.
There you go.
And I don't know whether I'm right about the path we'll take. I think I am. But I am quite confident that whatever path goes forward, we are going to be using genetics and whole genome sequencing more and more to try to influence the next generations.
Every new human that picks it up can think of new things to do with it that the original inventors couldn't possibly conceive. So a lot of this is going to unfold as we go forward.
Right. And one of the things I really like about my idea of easy PGD is it's the result of two things that are moving forward without people moving them forward because of reproduction. Whole genome sequencing is happening for medical and research purposes. It's going to happen whether or not there's a reproductive angle to it. Induced pluripotent stem cell research is happening for medical and research purposes. That's going to happen. We're going to learn how to manipulate those cells better and better without it being about reproduction. The reproductive uses are a secondary use of two different technologies coming together. And I think it's a nice example of unintended and unexpected consequences.
I was very taken with the concept of a child's right to an open future. What's an open future?
Well, it's a controversial concept. The idea is that parents, society, et cetera, shouldn't limit a child's possibilities. And on the one hand, we all nod and agree with that. I'm a parent. My kids are now 24 and 27. But I remember when they were 2 and 3, and I was trying to limit their future possibilities. I was trying to reduce the chance they grew up to be psychopathic criminals. we try to, it is our duty to try to guide and mold our children in some respects. And everything we do leads toward that. The actual concept came from a philosopher named Feinberg, and it was about a Supreme Court case involving the Amish and whether the Amish could keep their children out of public high school. His argument was you shouldn't let them keep their children out of public high school because that restricts their future too much. And I think most of us would agree parents shouldn't restrict their kids' futures too much, but we're always inherently, by everything we do with them, guiding their futures in some respects. So it's an interesting concept and maybe a guideline. It can't really be a practical, workable rule that we never do anything that closes off some of our children's futures.
It seems the technology is often a little ahead of the law, as in the 1950s case where a woman who used donated sperm was found guilty of adultery and the child was deemed illegitimate. That wouldn't fly today. But if easy PGD were a reality today, are there laws that which would prevent it, government regulations which would oversee it?
So it depends on where you are. In the United States, it is almost certain that the FDA would have to approve this before there was clinical use. I say almost certain because the 1938 Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, oddly enough, didn't envision easy PGD. But the FDA has taken the position that things that modify cells significantly are biologics or drugs and within its jurisdiction. And so the stem cell-derived egg would have to be approved by FDA. Once you get past that, in the United States, there's basically nothing. We don't regulate assisted reproduction very much. Other countries are very different. France, you can't get IVF unless you're a heterosexual couple. In Italy, you can't get IVF if the woman is over a certain age. In Germany, there are strong limitations on what you can use PGD for. In much of East Asia, there are very few limitations. So different cultures will set different stopping places. Right now in the U.S., though, apart from the safety issues, safety and efficacy issues that FDA looks at, there's really nothing. It's very odd. We have this powerful right to life movement, and yet of all the developed countries, we have the least regulated assisted reproductive industry in the world.
If you go to the U.K., every single one of these guys are tracked.
Yes, the U.K., I should have mentioned the U.K., the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, the HFEA, is very attractive in some respects to people like me because they have to approve every use of PGD, and they track every use of PGD, and they get very, very specific. There are pluses to that in terms of avoiding quackery or unsafe uses. There are also minuses, and you see a fair number of parents in the U.K. who can't get PGD done in the U.K. coming to the U.S. to getting it done here, which is, by the way, one big issue with any regulation of this. Reproductive tourism is not going to be all that difficult.
And in the U.K., you are required to make decisions within a fairly short amount of time, given your frozen embryos, whereas here in the United States, we have millions that go on and on.
Right. So frozen embryos is one area where at least some states have requirements. In Louisiana, you can never get rid of them. There's a story, and I don't think it's apocryphal, that in Hurricane Katrina, boats were dispatched to rescue tubes of liquid nitrogen frozen embryos from clinics because Louisiana law says you can't destroy them or let them be destroyed. Most states are not like that.
If you can take anybody's genes at any time, then it seems to me you could make yourself both strands of the DNA. And for people who are gay or lesbian, in which you have two females or two males, it seems to me they could also. Are you anticipating that?
I think that's a real possibility. It takes another scientific step. Being able to take cells from a man and make them into eggs and cells from a woman and make them into sperm. But people I talk to already are thinking about ways that could be done. Getting eggs from men seems to them somewhat easier than getting sperm from women, but there are paths both ways. The hardest one would be getting sperm from women that could give rise to boys because you'd need to add a Y chromosome. But getting sperm or sperm-like things from women that could give rise to girls doesn't seem implausible. And I think I look just in the U.S., millions of couples, of gay and lesbian couples, and many of them would love to have genetic children. Right now, they can't. The best you can do is an egg from one woman and a sperm from the other woman's brother. It's not the same. This opens possibilities for them that I think would be very exciting. And really, I think the first way the stem cell-derived gametes will be used is for the people, gay or straight, actually mainly straight in this case, who can't have genetic children because they don't make eggs or sperm. An accident, an illness, or in the case of women, often advancing age. This could solve those problems as well. And I think that's what it will first be approved by the FDA for use in infertility. You add the ability to do these cross-gender gametes. And then I think the gay and lesbian communities would be very interested in this technology.
Some people object to IVF in and of itself. They feel that fertilizing a woman's egg outside of her body and implanting it back is unacceptable. Others find IVF acceptable in principle, but have problems with the fertilized eggs, which were not used, either discarded or frozen. There's a sense that since we're not starting with a woman's egg, that easy PGD gets around all that. But I'm thinking it may not. Suddenly we can generate life in another way, and these same people may have objections because many more potential lives are created and discarded. I sort of feel like we're in this vortex of a massive ethical dilemma.
Well, I think you're right that the argument, you're not using an egg so it doesn't count, isn't going to fly. People who believe that embryos either are full human beings entitled to those rights or at least should be carefully treated and not created and destroyed will not like easy PGD. But they don't like IVF and PGD right now. And in the United States and most of the developed world, IVF and PGD are widely and legally practiced. So I think there will be objections, and not just from the Vatican City, though the Vatican City certainly will object. But as I look at the current political framework in much of the world, not all of it, Latin America, for example, is awfully restrictive. But as I look at the current framework, I don't think there are going to be too many countries that do major limitations on easy PGD. And, of course, even if there are, I can imagine the Grand Cayman Islands setting up easy PGD centers. Reproductive tourism is a way around governmental regulation that can be difficult for governments to stop.
Well, one last question here. It seems to me that whether it's exactly the technology you envision or some other embodiment, genetic choice is clearly coming our way, as well as genetic manipulation, which may solve some of what we envision today as irreversible genetic conditions. From your view, and you are confronted with challenges daily, from your view, how could we do this right in the next 20 to 40 years, and how might we do this wrong?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. That's, apart from the fact that it's great fun, that's why I do the work I do. I do it in the hope, and this is more faith-based than empirically founded, that if we think about these issues, if we argue about them, if we analyze them in advance, we are less likely to mess up badly. I used to say we can maximize the benefits and minimize the harms, and I realized that's way too much hubris in that statement. But if we can just avoid a few disasters, that would be a good thing. And so I think we need to get experts and non-experts talking about these issues. We need to have people think, so what would a good regulatory scheme look like? How would you try to stop reproductive tourism if you wanted to? What kind of laws do we need to keep people from stealing somebody else's cells and using them to make egg and sperm and make the person who left that water bottle in your office a parent without his knowledge? Some of those are expert questions, but many of them are public questions. What does the public want? What do people want their society to be like? And that question really works on two levels. What do you as a person or you as a family member want for your family? Do you want to use this? Don't you want to use it? Do you want to use it for serious diseases? Do you want to use it for everything? It's one level. The other level is, what do you think your society should do? What should the laws be? And I worry that we often don't do anything until the first case happens. And then in a huge rush to don't just stand there, do something, we throw things in which may or may not have been well thought out. So I think we've got lead time. I think we've got at least 20 years, but 20 years is not too long into the future for us to start thinking, arguing, discussing, understanding the options and choices and dilemmas and problems that control over our offspring's DNA is going to lead to.
Well, Hank, thank you so much for joining us. Please come back anytime.
Moira, this is great. A wonderful conversation. Thanks for your questions, and thanks for hosting me.
My guest today is Hank Greeley, formerly known as Henry T. Greeley, Stanford University professor and author of The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. It's published by Harvard University Press. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, the winner of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization's FutureMaker 2016 Award. It's Dr. Howard Jacobs, the Executive Vice President of the Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology in Huntsville, Alabama. Well, congratulations, Dr. Jacobs.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasant surprise.
Now we'll call you Howard.
How's that? Perfect.
Now we're back to normal. That was your award name.
Excellent.
Now we get to where the rubber meets the road. Now, what's the difference between genomics and genetics?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, they sound quite similar. And so the easy way to think about it is genetics is what you pass on to your children.
Okay, the DNA.
So the DNA that you pass off to your offspring, that's your genetic component. Your genomic component is what you have because you don't pass everything to any of your offspring. So genomics is your whole amalgamation of DNA.
So genomics is me and genetics is what you're passing along.
Perfect.
Okay, what's the difference though? Who cares?
Yeah, who cares? It's a great question.
I mean, mine.
You got yours, and yeah, we all got DNA, right?
Yeah.
So it really comes down to the DNA is your blueprint that determines who you are, what you're at risk for. And I like to have people think about it as it's your family history. We all know that's important. We fill those forms out when we go from doctor to doctor, and if the data is accurate, it's really a useful tool. The problem is that it's not accurate. We don't share information.
I've never lied
right?
on
exactly.
Ooh, exactly. I exercise all the time.
I really didn't have a Big Mac yesterday, right?
Yeah.
So those features then make it hard to actually practice medicine really effectively. So imagine being able to read somebody's blueprint, which is really what your DNA is. And I think it's amazing that in 2016, really one of the few things in the world that doesn't have a blueprint is a human. And we ask our physicians to make us better, help us out, tell us if we're going to get sick without having a blueprint. There's no other business that would suggest that they could do something without a blueprint.
Well, I could come in with on a flash drive with my DNA in it and say, here's my genomics, doc. And he'd say, do I have to take this?
Well, you know, I think part of the challenge is that we haven't been training our physicians to be ready for this, right? The other part is that we have to help the physicians practice medicine in the way they have to practice medicine. We hand them a huge amount of data and ask them to sort through it. Well, that's not helpful either, right? So one of the challenges that we're working on at Hudson Alpha is how do you – take the data that's really intricate, really complicated, and reduce it down to the level of practice between a physician and a patient. That's really the essential piece. Reading the DNA, yeah, there's a technical challenge of that. Analyzing the DNA, yeah, there's a technical challenge of that. But the practice of medicine is really, to me, where the rubber hits the road.
Well, give us some examples where we could do that today and some examples for where we will likely be able to do it tomorrow.
Yeah, so I think really what we can do today is in the area of undiagnosed disease or rare disease. And I think many of your listeners would be shocked to know that in 2016, there's between 20 and 30 million Americans that are really, really sick and nobody knows what's wrong with them. They go doctor to doctor, place to place. Many children that have this die before the age of 5 and nobody knows why. And so rare disease sounds like, well, how big of a problem can it be? It's rare. But rare is a medical definition, which means there's fewer than 200,000 patients that have the same clinical endpoints. So if we think about it, medicine is all about on average that medicine's safe for you to take. But what if you have a rare disease and there's nobody else like you? And the physician's never seen a case like you before. Where do you go then, right? So this is really where we've started. And we've spent the last 6 years now working on this. And it's been very helpful for patients and for families to understand what's wrong with their disease and their physician. So that's the start.
And how did that work? I mean,
so it works really quite well. It's not as well as maybe we'd like. It's not 100%. So without genomic information, people are reporting, including ourselves, that it's about 7% of the time you can get a diagnosis, the correct diagnosis.
But what does it do?
What does it do? Well, so you read the DNA, right? So you read all of their DNA, and then you go through this.
Do you do the DNA of the whole family?
Well, sometimes we do the whole family and sometimes we just do the individual. You can do both. It's helpful if you have the parents, but you can do it without. So you read all the DNA and you look at 4 to 6 million variations that makes us individual. And then you say, do any of those variations cause disease in this patient? So you can imagine that's a little bit of a puzzle that you have to sort through.
Yeah. You don't do that at home with index cards.
You do not do that with index cards. Computing is a really good idea.
So at Hudson Alpha, then, you have a whole series of analysis, the analytic tools that you can put this through.
Yeah, we have a bioinformatic group that has developed software that allows us to analyze a genome. You'd be surprised, or maybe your listeners would be surprised, that we can really analyze a genome, all that data, in less than 2 hours, and now generate a report. And if you think about, you know, the first human genome took a decade to figure that out. So we've really come a long way in the last 12 years.
And now what's your part in all this?
My job is to help manage the different teams. So we have a clinic. We have a clinical laboratory. We have a bioinformatics group. And we have an education group that's all part of this whole operation. And then I also have my own laboratory. And my laboratory's focus is that if we have a variation that's never been seen before and we think it causes disease, can we create either a cell system or a model system to be able to test that to help validate that that variation in that person's DNA is actually causal?
It seems to me that you just can't look at one person's DNA and another. You have to put like the human race together to see how humans operate, to understand. How do you bring all that or a sufficient amount of data together?
Well, so it's a great question. So the more genomes we sequence, the more value there is. So your DNA is valuable to you, obviously, as an individual. It's valuable to you as a family member. And it's also valuable to society because every genome we read then gives us information about what variation does. So in the example that we were talking about for the undiagnosed or rare disease, because it's rare, any variation that you or I would have in common with the patient, it can't be causal. So you just think of this as a big subtraction matrix. You start with, okay, here's all the variation in this person. Everybody's genome that we sequence, then we filter against that individual patient. We keep saying, okay, that can't be it, that can't be it, that can't be it, until you get to, oh, a eureka moment. Then that's where you know where it is. Now, let's imagine we have millions of genomes now sequenced. Well, now what we can start doing is start asking, how about for common disease? Can we start having enough information about variation? We know that diabetes, heart disease, cancer, they're all genetic, but they have more than one gene and they're common. So you need to have millions of people then that have been sequenced. So as you do that, then we move from reactive medicine, which is you go to the doctor when you're sick, or what I call disease care, to healthcare, which is you now start having prospective medicine. You now start saying, oh, Howard, you're at risk for this disease. You have this variation. And in fact, in my case, my genome has been read. I have a mutation in one of my DNA pieces that determines drug metabolism. There's 50 common drugs that I don't manage on average the same way. Now, the only way I would have known that without my DNA would be to take a drug and have a side effect.
So if you got one of the conditions that needed one of those drugs, right away you'd start off on the wrong foot treating
it. On the wrong drug. Yep, exactly.
Now, are all these databases, all this sequencing, is this all being developed at Hudson Alpha, or are you in partnership with other institutes?
Well, it's a combination of things. So Hudson Alpha actually has the capacity to sequence 18,000 patients a year. So we have a big capacity. But we also partner with other groups to look at this. So we have grants from the National Institutes of Health to understand rare undiagnosed disease. So in fact, we are one of the sequencing cores for the Undiagnosed Disease Network. And we're also a clinical site for the Clinical Sequencing Exploratory Research. So these are grants that are really focused on how do we do this clinically. And in those cases, we're partnering with people from around the country. And then we have, of course, collaborations with other people outside the U.S. as well to try to bring together these large data sets and use the information collectively to improve how often we can make a diagnosis.
Well, HudsonAlpha.org, nonprofit.
Correct.
How does this relate to for-profit, anything from individual clinical care up to pharmacy? I mean, How does that line cross?
Yeah, so Hudson Alpha is a unique place. So we have a not-for-profit side and we also have a for-profit side. So we have 16 faculty on the not-for-profit side and we have 34 companies on the for-profit side. Many of those companies are designated and designed to leverage what we're learning on the not-for-profit side and turning it into commercial applications so we can get it out into healthcare. So the future is today we're doing rare and undiagnosed disease. In the future, what we want to do is be able to do everybody. So we have another program that we're doing, which is we're trying to help adoptees get a medical record by using their DNA. And as we do that, combined with rare disease, the third piece that we're looking at is people are presumably healthy. So how do you take the information of how did you make a electronic medical record, if you will, with an adoptee to somebody who's really, really sick, we don't know what's wrong with them, and then how do we translate that information into somebody who doesn't know they're sick or isn't sick at this point? I mean, we're all going to die, so what can we get information on that? So that's something that we call an insight genome. So to us, we see this as a continuum that eventually, I hope, we'll have someday that the day you're born, you get your DNA read. You start giving your care team from the very beginning an upper hand in helping you go forward. Now we do have to solve a few things like ethics, data return. How is that protected? How does insurance deal with that? So there are some complexities around the social side. But let's imagine we get through those and you now have a blueprint. I'm sure your physician will practice better medicine with a blueprint, just like your mechanic does a better job with a blueprint.
It occurs to me, especially in the case of adoptees, is that, you know, someone in your past had this, had that, and you have an inheritance there that is totally independent of whether or not you find these people, you're near them, whatever happened along there. That's a very important part that tells you your heritage.
Correct. And what you're at risk for. Imagine going to see a doctor and not being able to fill out that form. It's something we do automatically without even thinking about it.
Where was cancer in your family? Who had this? Does
exactly.
anybody in your family have
exactly.
that? You know, right. all of this, and you don't know.
Right. And then what does your physician do, right? So they can only look at you and measure what they can measure at that point in time and say, well, Howard, as near as we can tell, everything's fine.
Well, Howard, congratulations on your award, Future Maker 2016.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Dr. Howard Jacobs is the Executive Vice President of the Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology in Huntsville, Alabama, and the winner of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization's Future Maker 2016 Award. More information about the Hudson Alpha Institute is available on the web at hudsonalpha.org. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.